Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Daily Premier League news and views. This is Football Social Daily.
Manchester United have a new interim manager. Ralf Rangnick has been confirmed as the man to take over at Old Trafford until the end of the season. After the divorce from Solskjaer, will United now enter the honeymoon period with the 63-year-old German, who is known for his intense style of play? There's Premier League action this evening too, as we embark on the first fixtures of a double game week. And is Newcastle United's relationship with the top flight at risk of breaking down? A huge clash on Tyneside tonight in a cliched relegation six-pointer as Norwich are the visitors. Just how big is this game for Eddie Howe and his players? Also last night, Lionel Messi continued his long-standing relationship with the Ballon d'Or. The little magician winning it for the seventh time in his career. But we ask, did he deserve it this time amidst some strong Premier League representation? This is Football Social Daily, your daily fling for all things Premier League. Keep right up to date with the latest happenings in the English top flight by hitting subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Niall and joining me as my lawful wedded pundits today, we've got Bachelor Joel Tudor. Morning, Joel.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning, morning. And newly hitched off the market, Marley Anderson, fresh from his wedding day this weekend, is also with us too. Welcome back, Marley. How was it?
Yeah, it was decent. Yeah, not such a bad decent. Day. Decent. Yeah, no, it was class. Yeah, proper love the day. This is, if you can hear this, that'll tap in. That's my wedding ring, which I'm currently still getting used to. It's very strange wearing it.
I thought you were going to say it's the can of Strongbow that I'm still going.
Well, you got a tin stuff on your finger.
Bloody tin. Solid white gold,
tin.
Damn it.
Yeah, same.
I'll crack it off your head tomorrow when I see you.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire for Marley Anderson, back on the podcast on the day of the biggest game of Newcastle United season, in my opinion anyway. We'll hear the thoughts of Marley, who is a bona fide Toon supporter, in a little bit. But first of all, we need to talk about the news that everyone was waiting for. Ralf Rangnick has been confirmed by Manchester United as their new interim manager. He'll take the reins from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for the next 6 months before moving upstairs into a consultancy role. He'll arrive at Old Trafford, though, subject to the approval of a working visa. Can't imagine it'll take too long for that to be confirmed, but it's unlikely he'll take charge of United's game this week at Old Trafford against Arsenal. It's more likely to be the game after that in which we see Rangnick. But this is the news everyone was expecting. It's now become official. It's been met with huge positivity, Marley, both within the club and from outside. Can you understand why that might be the case?
Yeah, I can understand it. They clearly wanted a change. It seemed like the fan base had given up, basically. If not before that Watford game, then especially that Watford game was the tipping point. I'm just happy that Ralf Rangnick's finally got a bloody job, because I am sick to death of him getting mentioned and linked with every top job going in England and then not getting it and not getting anywhere near it, really. I think he was linked with Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool in the past sort of 4 or 5 years, and it's one of them. He's like, does he exist? Like, if he doesn't get a job, does he ever really exist, this guy? And finally, Man United have went and pulled the trigger and hired him. And it's now about what he can do, because, as you mentioned in the intro, I think he's sort of known for his pressing, and his philosophy and his style of play is quite unique, and you know what you're going to get, sort of thing. And a lot of criticism has came Man United's way for not pressing and not being a pressing team who go on the front foot. Like, even when they haven't got the ball, they're not that brave. They don't play such a high line in recent sort of seasons. And it's worked for them to an extent, but, you know, it seems like the sexy thing to do these days is play football like that, play risky stuff where you send your fullbacks way up the pitch, and, you know, they sort of press. It's very similar to what Liverpool do, and Manchester City in a way as well. But it'd be interesting, because Man United's squad isn't set up like that. Now, we've seen Harry Maguire struggle. Every time he's close to the halfway line, he's in danger of getting spun, and he's not winning a foot race against anyone. So we'll see if he can do it. It's a test of how good this manager is, and well, the proof will be in the pudding, I suppose.
I suppose on that point, Joel, Marley mentions the intensity and the style of play. Obviously, Rangnick is known as the father of the gegenpress, and many coaches that we see in the Premier League and across the world now have taken inspiration from him. Managers like Klopp and Tuchel, Ralf Hasenhüttl, Jesse Marsh, the current RB Leipzig manager, have all said that this guy is someone they've drawn ideas from. But in terms of him being the real deal and these methods and styles shining through, how long do you think it will take for that to happen? How long do you think it will take for that philosophy to come across on the pitch? Is there an argument to suggest we already saw a small snapshot of that against Chelsea at the weekend?
With this, I'm cautiously optimistic, just because he's been out of management for quite a while now. I think it's a good 3 years. And yeah, I know he has quite a good PR at the moment with all these videos. I must have seen that video more times than like United versus Chelsea in Moscow. It's just, I feel like with his style, when I look at, like, for example, a pressing team, one that has really high intensity, is a style that can be implemented pretty much instantaneously. And that's not to say that it's going to be effective, but it can be done quite quick, because obviously when you think back to, for example, when Guardiola first came, and obviously when Klopp first came, I remember in Guardiola's first few games, you could tell exactly what he was trying to do, but he just couldn't do it because he didn't have the right quality of players. He didn't have the specialist players who, you know, you actually need for that kind of style of play. I remember, you know, his defenders coming right to the byline where the goalkeeper was, trying to take the ball and play out from the back, and you can see what they're trying to do early, but obviously it's a different matter not having the correct players to do that. But I think with this United side, obviously any team can press. I mean, it's not hard to just run and try and chase the ball, but you need to have method with it. And I think that can be implemented pretty quickly, considering the fact that we do have a good young crop of players who can do that. I mean, we saw that against Chelsea at the weekend, with, you know, Sancho and Rashford. They basically brought our own goal on out of absolutely nothing, purely through just pressuring Jorginho on the ball when he looked a bit vulnerable at the back. So I think that it's why I say cautiously optimistic, is because I'm also aware that he only has 6 months, and it takes a good few years to really truly show what changes you're making to the side. And that's why I think it's just the perfect transition for the next manager, because obviously if it's Pochettino, we know that his sides work extremely hard. And the stats tell you that in every single season that he was at Tottenham, they were one of the hardest working sides in the Premier League. So I think that It's just a nice transition, and I don't expect miracles, because, you know, he's never had one of the top jobs in football. It's always been kind of, you know, at Hoffenheim or Leipzig. It's never been Bayern. It's never been Barcelona. It's always been the kind of, you know, the teams that he's been able to build from the ground up. And obviously his work at Salzburg and his work at Leipzig, it took the best part of a decade to really get that fully flowing. So I don't expect, you know, massive miracles, but I mean, I think the new manager lift will be apparent very, very quickly. And I'll be optimistic, for example, in the Champions League, just because I feel like our side has just been so reliant on just moments of magic to get us out of games. You know, for example, Ronaldo's basically kept us in the competition out of nothing. So I think having a good method and a system in place can only benefit us, because in the last months it's felt like they've just been told to go out on the pitch and just try your best, and that's not good enough for a United side. I mean, after David De Gea said against Watford that we don't know how to defend, we don't know what to do, I'm pretty sure in the next 2 to 3 weeks you'll never hear that comment again, because Rangnick's the kind of guy who is absolutely detail orientated and he knows exactly what every player should be doing. And that's what the club's been missing for quite a long time. So I'm quite surprised that the coaching staff have survived under him, to be honest, because they're part of the problem from Solskjaer's era.
I think it's an interesting discussion to be had in general, kind of taking a few ingredients from what each of you have said. Paul Merson is someone on Sky Sports who often gets a lot of stick for his views, and he's been absolutely shot down on Twitter by suggesting, why has Rangnick never been given one of the bigger jobs? But Joel, you've just mentioned that as well. That's not to denigrate the work he did at Leipzig, Schalke, Hoffenheim. There is absolutely no way that any of us are suggesting that he doesn't deserve the job because of the previous clubs he's managed. But then going off of what you said, Marley, about he's always linked with the top jobs, but he never gets them. Manchester United say that Rangnick was their number one choice for interim boss. What do you make of that? And what do you make of all the discussion around, is he capable of doing the job because he's never managed a club on the scale of Manchester United? Do you think that's a fair criticism to level at him? Or do you think it's just something that people are trying to use to maybe question his ability?
It's probably a bit of both. I mean, people in, you know, English people are very sort of, well, he's never done it here, so what's he ever done kind of thing. They're a bit sort of ignorant to things. And as you say, as Joel said, you know, he's built clubs from very low expectations to very attractive sides before. Obviously, it's a very different thing at Man United, because you're not going to get that time, and you're not going to get that sort of, like, people aren't going to look at it and go, well, let's see what he can do, let's give him a couple of years and what have you. So it is completely different. However, one thing which I think Rangnick does, and I can't think of another manager who does this at all in the world, is he bridges the role of manager and sort of sporting director style role, like, or what do you call it? You know, the head of football. What do they call it now? The one
technical director or whatever it's called.
Yeah, you know, that role is very like boardroom only. And obviously head coach is very training ground, pick the team orientated.
Because he was sporting director at Lokomotiv Moscow. That was his most recent job, which United had to obviously get him out of that to bring him to the club.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't think of many managers who do both those roles, who get linked with both those like vacancies at clubs. So I think the six-month thing, I think it fits what Man United are trying to do perfectly, because they want someone for 6 months because they know that people will be available in the summer. Maybe Pochettino, maybe Ten Hag, maybe whoever else, maybe Zidane might fancy it. I don't know, whoever it may be. But they also don't want to lose Rangnick because they know he can move upstairs in a heartbeat and have an overview of how the club goes forward in the next 2 years after that. So I think they've been clever with it.
Do you think that consultancy role is just as important as the hands-on coaching? Because we know it'll only be 6 months until the end of the season, but it's a further 2 years moving upstairs. And I think that, for me, that was the sweetener for the deal, because I think United offered him just the interim job, and he said no, because he wanted something more long-term. And then they came back with the two-year consultancy thing on top of the 6 months coaching, and he said yes to that. So do you think that that will be just as important as the actual on the training ground, putting all the pieces in place before moving upstairs? Do you think that actual move to the boardroom level, so to speak, is going to be just as important?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's I think that role at Man United right now, the upstairs role, is more important than the manager's job, because I think a lot of managers could get, you know, a good result out of Man United. They've got the squad, they've got enough players. There's no real, other than defensive midfield, there's no really gaping holes in that team where you go, they're not good enough there. Their attack is, you know, the options they've got in attack are mad. They've got two of the best goalkeepers in the country, really, on the day. De Gea's back to somewhere near his best. Dean Henderson lost that race, but also still better than most number twos in the Premier League. You know, they've got defenders, just signed Varane. Yes, you know, Lindelof's not great, but I still think a good manager could get something out of him. So I think where Man United have fell apart in the last few years is the fact they've had an accountant making the decisions upstairs, and Edward would, you know, he's trying his best, but he doesn't know football. He doesn't know football well enough. Ralph Rangnick couldn't open an Excel spreadsheet, but does know the best young players in Russia and Germany and stuff like that, and how to get the best out of them. Or you would hope so, anyway. Mm. But we'll see about that. But definitely the upstairs role in 6 months' time was the sweetener for him, 100%, because that's what type of role he's used to and what type of role he thrives in.
I've got two more questions before we move on, and I'll direct both of them at you, Joel, seeing as you're the Manchester United fan here. The first is that Rangnick says his immediate aim is to help the players fulfil their potential. That's a direct quote from him in the press release after his appointment, fulfil their potential. Firstly, is that something you think was missing under Solskjaer, this ability to squeeze as much juice as possible out of the talent that Manchester United inevitably have? And second of all, what represents success for Rangnick? We talk about this two-year consultancy role, but that's in the future. The immediate is the now and making Manchester United better on the pitch. What do you think Rangnick can achieve or should be aiming to achieve? What are the expectations between now and the end of the season for him from Manchester United fans?
Yeah, I think with this United side, and as we've seen throughout football, the only way a player can truly realise his potential is if, obviously, one, they work hard, which is a given, but the main point is that they get coached very, very well. As you see under Guardiola, some of those players without him wouldn't be at the level that they're at now. Same with some of the players under Pochettino when Spurs were going for the title and they got the Champions League final. They went levels up because of one thing, and that's the coaching. And with Solskjaer, he wasn't getting enough out of the players. I mean, to be fair, I would give him credit for example, Mason Greenwood's rise. I think he used him really well in the side and integrated him really well. But apart from him, I don't think I can name too many players who've really grown massively under him. And that's quite a big concern because we've got a lot of young, talented players in there. You know, Rashford, Greenwood, obviously, to be fair, Shaw's had his best season under Solskjaer, but Shaw's been a player who's kind of hit a peak and then hit a trough and then hit a peak again, but he's been under his best football. But this is what I mean, the reason why he's gone, Ollie, is because he hit his ceiling. And when a manager hits his ceiling, how on earth are you meant to get more out of your players? And I think with someone like Rangnick, who we know is very, very, you know, meticulous, he's very detailed, data-driven type coach, which is, it seems to be the complete opposite to how Ollie was, who was a bit more motivational, a bit more philosophical, like, you know, wear your heart on your sleeve type stuff. And I think the players, especially in this day and age, I think you need a manager like that who's very, you can analyse your performance and see exactly where you need to improve. Because a lot of our players, especially in the final third under Solskjaer, they just look clueless. And I go back to David De Gea's comments because I think they were really understated just how bad that of a reflection it was on Solskjaer. The fact that the players just didn't know what system they were using, what was going on. And when the new manager comes in, and as we know, you know, Rangnick's oversaw some very, very, very good young players in Europe, you know, like Upamecano, Sadio Mane, and they've all gone on to become great players. And at the start of the career, I'm sure that his guidance and his methodologies at the start have really helped them, you know, become some of the players that they are today. And I think that since we have such a young squad and so many up and coming young players coming through, it is vital that we have a manager like this at this stage, and especially going forward after him. For example, Pochettino or Ten Hag, they're both renowned for nurturing young talent. Solskjaer wasn't. He was still a very relatively pretty unproven manager. We weren't really meant to be carrying on with him after he actually got hired following those 10 games. So it's the right time to have a manager in who truly understands what it takes to get the best out of players. And it's tried and proven, which is what United should have always gone for. I think it was a massive risk at the start. And as to what you said, what kind of constitutes a success, I mean, considering the state we're in right now, top four has to be the kind of the aim, which is quite bad to say, and it annoys me because we have the squad capable of going for the title, in my opinion. But I feel as though with how good Chelsea, City and Liverpool are, they're not going to drop many points this year. And I feel like, what is it now, a 12-point gap between us and Chelsea, I still feel like it's way too much. And I think you live in a dream world if you think Rang is going to kind of manoeuvre things that much that we're going to be on all front for, all firing for the title. It's not going to happen. So I think realistically, top four is going to be the aim, which is still a very, very competitive place to come, because there's probably six teams, I would say, who have a realistic chance of trying to break into it. And I think in terms of Europe, you know what, like, the sky's the limit with that competition. We've seen how bad teams can really just kind of try the luck in that competition, especially Chelsea, both times. So yeah, the Champions League is a very hit or miss. You have to have all the cards fall into your place. And obviously Rangnick got to the semi-finals with Schalke when we played them in 2009, and yeah, we absolutely battered them. But I mean, to get Schalke to a Champions League semi-final is a pretty decent achievement. So you know, he's gone far. Similar with Ten Hag, who got to the semi-finals too. And I would just kind of let him go with the flow with that competition. I mean, the world's your oyster with it. But I don't, this is what I mean, a lot of Man United fans are getting their head in the clouds thinking he's going to absolutely dominate. And you have to manage expectation, I think, and just be cautiously optimistic, because this squad is still damaged from the last 3 months and it's going to take a little bit of time. But top four for me is probably success this year.
Top four, says Joel. Manchester United currently in eighth position in the Premier League on 18 points. They are 5 points off of those top four spots, those Champions League positions. And they take on Arsenal, who are also on 23 points, level with fourth-placed West Ham. They can claw back some ground on those Champions League positions if they can beat the Gunners. That game, though, doesn't take place until Thursday. There are two Premier League games which are happening tonight. In the first of a double game week, huge, huge week this for Newcastle United. We'll talk about their game against Norwich City after this here on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back. This is Football Social Daily, the daily Premier League podcast from Sports Social. If you hit subscribe, that way you won't miss another episode again. Brand new shows every single day of the top flight season. We'll have all of the games previewed and reviewed for you in this hectic period of fixtures, including over Christmas as well, where there's plenty going on in the top flight. But our focus for now is on this evening's action. There are two games, Newcastle versus Norwich and Leeds versus Crystal Palace. For me, the game at St. James's Park, of huge magnitude tonight, not just for Norwich City, but more so for me, for Newcastle United. It's been a really turbulent year or so, Marley, for you as a Newcastle United fan. The optimism on Tyneside, it seems from the outside looking in, is at an all-time high, particularly in terms of the vibe around the club after the departure of Mike Ashley and the introduction of the Saudi Arabians as the club's new owners. Steve Bruce was dismissed, Eddie Howe was brought in, but the club are still bottom of the Premier League table. They haven't won a game yet this season, 13 games in, and they are adrift at the bottom of the table at the moment, 6 points from safety. So Norwich City come to town having sacked their manager, Daniel Farke. Dean Smith's been installed. They've won two and drawn one of their last three. But from a Newcastle perspective, just how big is this game and this week for the club?
Oh, this is, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. We absolutely have to take 6 points from our next two games. We've got Norwich and then we've got Burnley after that, both at home. We should have beat Brentford. We didn't really expect to beat Arsenal the way they're playing at the minute. But yeah, we should have beat Brentford a couple of weeks ago. Carl Darlow cost us big time in that game, to be fair. And then Norwich tonight, you know, if Norwich beat us, we're 6 points behind them, I think it is. So you can't ask for a better game. Eddie Howe's first game at the St. James's Park touchline because he had COVID for the Brentford draw. And yeah, it's absolutely massive. I think there's still this sort of attitude around sort of the Premier League right now that Newcastle will be all right because they're going to spend loads of money in January, and I'm just not feeling the same way. I'm starting to really worry about how much work we've got to do, because I don't think 25 games left it's not that much because we've, you know, we haven't won any of our first 13. So are we going to win 13 of our next 25? It's, you know, it's not cut and dry. This is a seriously dangerous position to be in, and the start we made under Steve Bruce is what's really hindered us, because we had a lot of winnable games and we didn't win any of them. In the first 10 games, I think we had 6 or 7 that were easily winnable. Didn't have many of the huge superpowers that you don't expect to beat. And our December's looking horrendous, because that's when we do play those big boys. We play Liverpool, Man City, Chelsea are in there as well. And you know, that's the work Eddie Howe's got to do now. That's the hand he's been dealt. And I'm starting to think, is it a little bit too much? Because we have improved, 100% we've improved since he's come in, but we still look weak at the back. And how many games are we going to score one more than them or two more than them, you know what I mean? So it's a very big task, and the work needs to start tonight.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, Eddie Howe, since he's come in, you mentioned Steve Bruce in the start that the club made under him at the beginning of this season. Eddie Howe's come in, missed the first game, as you say, due to a positive COVID test. He's negative now. He was on the touchline for the Arsenal game, but this will be his first game in the dugout at St. James's Park. But do you think that counts for a great deal? Have you seen improvement under Eddie Howe, first off? And second off, do you think him being there in person on the touchline at St. James's will add much to it or not?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely to both questions you asked there. The improvement has been obvious to see. I think the biggest example of that is the Brentford game. We had 53% possession, and I think I'm right in saying that's the first time we've dominated. We've had more possession than anybody in the league this season. We've never had more than 50%. And when Bruce was in charge, it was quite often in the 20s and the low 30s, below 35%. And yeah, some games, you know, you're not going to see the ball for long periods of time, but we know Brentford can play, and we know Brentford like to have the ball themselves. So to beat them in the possession stats was a massive highlight of what Eddie Howe is trying to do. He's trying to play with the ball, trying to impose what we can do on the opposition. And you know, we had twice as many shots on target. And everything like that. So there was immediately something to cling on to there. And obviously, as I mentioned, if Darlow had done his job properly, we'd have won that game. But he ended up spooning Ivan Toney's relatively tame shot into the net. And that's just the way it goes. But it's that type of luck that needs to start changing, because we are going to need a little bit of luck to get out of this, because it's a really tough situation to be. We need to start nicking points here and there and defending better and being hard to score against. And hopefully it all happens tonight.
Yeah, massive game. Not just for Newcastle, but also for Norwich City, Joel, because we were all writing them off at the start of the season. Daniel Farke was on the worst losing streak in Premier League history in terms of a managerial standpoint. He did win against Brentford before the international break in his final game as Norwich manager, but he was given his marching orders. And many people were surprised at that the club sacked him after a win. But that's been quickly forgotten, because Dean Smith's come into Norwich City after his dismissal as Aston Villa manager, and they look much sprightlier for me under him. Is that new manager bounce that we talk about, or are they genuinely a better side now under Smith after just two games? What's the difference? Is it the new manager bounce, or is it something Smith's done, do you think?
Honestly, he's been in charge for 3 games now, hasn't he? Where he's got 2 wins and a draw. I think, honestly, I was more impressed with the draw against Wolves, just because we've seen how solid Wolves have been this season. They went undefeated in, like, I think 6 or 7 games. Just recently got beat by West. Oh no, they beat West Ham. Yeah, so they've been in an amazing run of form. And let's not forget, before Farke got that win and he got sacked, they lost 20 Premier League games before that. And considering he's undefeated now in 3, I mean, I've written them off completely just before they got that first win of the season. They looked absolutely terrible. They were literally they got beat by Chelsea 7-0 just before they got that win. They looked absolutely done and dusted. So I think for me, I think Dean Smith has got a massive, he's got a massive point to prove after that Villa dismissal. I think he's really wanting to prove to everyone, because I think personally it was a little bit harsh to sack him from Villa at that point he was at, just because of how many massive injuries and team selection issues he had. But now I think he's just, I think it was like the relief that the Norwich team's kind of feeling after Farke's left, because I think it just went too far. After you've lost that many games under a manager, I think they just completely lose belief. And I don't know if you
the
can ever...
The rot was set, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you need to cut it by the roots. You can't keep trimming the leaves. And I think the whole team had just came to a kind of resound decision that it wasn't going their way. And they needed a new manager to come in and actually make them believe again. And it's clear to see. I mean, they clearly have the quality. If, you know, the first game, they won away to Brentford. I mean, I don't know the last time they actually won an away Premier League game. And obviously they beat Southampton, then obviously that 0-0 draw against Wolves. And what's most impressive to me is they've only conceded 2 in 3, considering how much they've been leaking goals this season in the Premier League. I mean, I think they conceded, 27 goals, which is the second highest in the league this season. And now they've conceded 2 in the last 3. And that just shows they have the quality there, but they just needed that separation from Farke, because it was going absolutely nowhere. And I totally, even when they, you know, when they get the sacking after he won that game, I was surprised everyone was so shocked at that, because the damage was already done. It was done way before that. And I think they saw that probably, I think 2 weeks ago they made that decision, regardless of what the results did. I think that result was a bit of a flash in the pan type result. And I don't think the players believed it.
I think because both sides played against each other in the Championship last season, it was one of the few teams Norwich could come up against and feel like were able to give them a good game. I think where there's plenty of scars from the last time they're in the Premier League under the same manager, many of the same players. So, you know, they did look a shell of the side that won the Championship last season, but Daniel Farke has gone, Dean Smith's come in, and Norwich have looked better. Just finally on Newcastle then, because I think that the emphasis should be on your team here, Marley. Everyone is suggesting Newcastle are heading towards the January window where they can make some reinforcements and give themselves a boost, but there are still 7 games, including tonight's game, between now and the new year, and there are the likes of City, United, Liverpool and Leicester all to come between now and the end of December. It feels like it doesn't matter who you're linked with right now. The focus has to be in the next 2 games, in the next 5 days, because it could be a case of too little, too late.
Yeah, definitely. All I want for Christmas this year is just 3 points, a win. I was honestly hoping that on Saturday my team would win a game and give me the best wedding present ever. And I looked at the score halfway through, like just before I started my speech, and it was like, you lost 2-0. I was like, ah, there we go, never mind. But yeah, it needs to start. It needs to start now. If not tonight, I'd be tempted to chuck money on Newcastle going down, because it needs to start now, as we've been saying. You know, we've got Norwich and Burnley. Then our next run of 3 is Leicester, Liverpool, Man City, and then Man United after that. So if you look at that, takes us up to the 30th of December. And if you've got no wins by then, you are... I mean, Harry Houdini would have a job getting out of that, never mind Eddie Howe, so... Yeah, it needs to start now.
Well, eyes of Newcastle will be on the game tonight against Norwich, but there'll also be perhaps a little bit of a side eye on Leeds against Crystal Palace, considering where Leeds are in the Premier League table. This one kicks off at 8:15 at Elland Road. Leeds absolutely desperate for a win. They can't be leapfrogged tonight, but Norwich can go level on points with them if they beat Newcastle in that aforementioned game. It's a huge week for Leeds with Palace and Brentford, before they've got games with Chelsea, City, Arsenal and Liverpool all consecutively up till Boxing Day. So much like Newcastle with that tough run through December, so have Leeds United. They've got to win tonight, Joel, haven't they, to really put themselves at ease of getting dragged into that relegation battle if they're not already in it. What's your take?
Yeah, it's a massive game for Leeds. I'm quite surprised with the downfall in that side this year. I don't know if it's because, you know, Bamford's out and Calvin Phillips has been in and out of the side, but they look an absolute shell of what they did last year. I mean, they were getting praise for getting battered by United 6-1 at Old Trafford just because they were pressing and showing energy and that kind of thing. And now I'm not seeing anything at all. I think for Leeds, And it's the same issue with Newcastle. I feel like both of them just need a win. They need that catalyst to kind of kick on a little bit. But the only issue they have is that they're not taking their chances in the games that are winnable. When they come up again, because I know Leeds have got, what, Chelsea, City, United, they basically got all of the top six nearly in the next six games. And they could end up getting leapfrogged by Norwich, I would not be surprised, in the next two games, three games, and they could find themselves in a real bad mess. And I never would have thought I would be saying that after last season. I mean, I think this time last season, I was looking yesterday before my preview, that Leeds were 13th with 17 points this time last year at the same stage of the season. And now they find themselves 17th with 12 points. So it's not a massive difference, but it also is a massive difference objectively if you watch them play. And I think, yeah, tonight, it seems like that stage of the season where everything's kind of a must win, isn't it? You know, Leeds against Crystal Palace is a winnable game. Then they've got Brentford. The next two are vital to kind of ease the pressure. I don't think it's a case of winning to kind of stay up. It's more so a case of keeping the heads above water, because obviously you've got Chelsea, City, Arsenal, Liverpool, then Villa in the next games after that. And if they don't get a result in those next two games, that could be seven games that they end up throwing in succession. So I think it is vital that these games, the winnable ones, are the ones that they really treat with like the utmost certainty, because, you know, it's easy to overlook the fact that, you know, it's two games and they've got five games. It's the big guns in the league. But you could find yourself seven games in again. Suddenly it's gone and you got 3 points from seven games, and suddenly you're in a real battle then when it comes to January. So in terms of must win, yeah, I've always been a believer at this stage of the season that it's never done and dusted, just because we've seen it many, many times before in the history of the Premier League, where, you know, 10 games to go, six games to go, miracles do happen and players suddenly kind of start realizing the mess that they're actually in. And sometimes they get like a new manager bounce if clubs want to kind of stick or twist, but it's a dire situation at Leeds at the moment. And I'm surprised, because they've got such quality in there. Like, I mean, Rafinha has been real standout player for them, and it's a case of scoring. I mean, I'm just looking at their results and it's all just 1-0s, 0-0s, then yeah. they can't score.
But Patrick Bamford's been out for ages, which 100%. Is probably part of the reason of that. They have had injuries, and actually Patrick Bamford played 90 minutes for Leeds under 23s last night, so it's unlikely that he'll be involved against Crystal Palace this evening at Elland Road. But you never know, stranger things have happened. Luke Ayling also played in that game, so they have had their injuries. Calvin Phillips was missing for a period as well, but maybe you're right. Maybe they've just found this season slightly tougher, the return of fans to stadiums and the injuries. And, you know, it's a tough league, the Premier League, and we always said that Leeds were a side that were greater than the sum of their parts individually in terms of quality. There aren't that many squads that are worse off than Leeds, if that makes sense. So I think that certainly it was always going to be tough this time around. As for Crystal Palace, you can almost level the opposite of them. Many people tipping them to go down this season, but Patrick Vieira has come in and done a really, really good job so far. They've drawn more games than any other side in the Premier League, though, Marley. Seven times they've tied a game. That surely has to swing one way or another for them soon. They can't keep drawing every match.
Well, they'll give it the best shot by the looks of it. It's... I always feel like with teams that draw a lot of games, the first one that you don't draw is just huge, because then you can say, like, if you draw, for example, five in a row and then you lose the sixth, it's six games without a win. But if you win the sixth game, it's six games unbeaten. So it puts a massive spin on where you sort of perceive to be. But seven draws and they're 11th in the league, so it's sort of like leveled out perfectly. You'd expect the team who's drawn the most games to be around mid-table, and that's exactly where they are. But one thing that's for sure is that they've been much, much improved since Patrick Vieira came in. There's a lot more dynamic sort of attack into their play. They've got some exciting players. I think last year they had the most boring squad in the world. Nobody tunes in to watch James McArthur, Luka Milivojevic and Jeffrey Schlupp try and create chances for Christian Benteke. They just don't. But now, you know, Elise, Eze, Zaha, Edward, Gallagher's been amazing. Gaze chipped in with a couple of goals recently as well from centre-back. And there's a lot of stuff to be excited about for Crystal Palace fans, and that's all. You know, I think back to last season when we talked about Palace, it was just stale. They just needed something. They needed some sort of personality to come in and to ignite them a bit, and that's what Vieira's done. And even though they've only won three games this season, the draws have been like late goals, and they've been close to wins. And you know, if they just happened to not concede late in two of those games, they'd be seventh in the league right now. So you know, that shows you that they're a decent team.
Yeah, I totally agree. Big game tonight for Leeds United. Crystal Palace, never easy, particularly in what they've shown this season so far. 8:15 p.m. kickoff between those two at Elland Road. Right, that's it for tonight's Premier League fixtures. There are more throughout the rest of the week. Wednesday and Thursday there are games. We'll look ahead to those on tomorrow's podcast and the day after, of course. And if you hit subscribe on Football Social Daily, wherever you listen to your podcasts, that way you won't miss one. But after this break, we're going to talk about the Ballon d'Or, because the awards ceremony was last night. Lionel Messi won the award for the seventh time in his career, but did he deserve it? We'll ask that question next after this on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk. Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back. This is Football Social Daily. I'm Niall, Joel Tudor and Marley Anderson alongside me. And we're going to talk about the Ballon d'Or now. The award ceremony was last night. Lionel Messi was voted as the winner of the award, which translates from French to golden ball. It's effectively a marker of who's the best player in the world. Or at least it used to be. There are some question marks after last night's decision to hand Messi the seventh award of his career as to whether it's just a glorified popularity contest. So who would have been your pick, Marley? We'll come to you first for the winner of the award last night. Did Messi deserve it? Would he have been your choice to win a seventh award of his career?
No, absolutely not. I still think he had a decent year, but when... The thing with Messi is when you've been at such a level, you know, I think back to, I think was it the 2012 or 13 season where he scored 91 goals in a calendar year or something like that. When you come down from that level, even though you're at still a very high level, I just think it's hard to ignore other players, because it's almost like he's made that sort of level for himself of like, yeah, I am clearly the most talented player in the world, but he hasn't had the best season. And it's hard to look past Robert Lewandowski for that season, because he's just, I think he's got 48 goals in 40 games. You know, he's the most talented player, or has been for the last year. So I'd be fuming if I wasn't him.
Why do you think he didn't win it? Because by all accounts, Lionel Messi has allegedly come out and said that he feels sorry for Lewandowski, and that actually he thinks that Lewandowski deserves to have won the award last night, which obviously isn't going to make Robert Lewandowski feel any better about it. But what do you think the reasons are? I thought Ali McCoy said something interesting on national radio this morning about French journalists and Spanish journalists aren't going to vote for Lewandowski. South American journalists aren't going to vote for Lewandowski, because, of course, the Ballon d'Or is chosen by a panel of 180 different journalists around the world. So do you think that that's part of the reason?
Maybe. I just think Messi's a bigger brand. He's a bigger name. He's a sexier name, isn't he, than Lewandowski. I think Lewandowski's been at such a high level, but it's always consistent. Like, he always gets 30 goals a season, you know. Whereas Messi is like, sometimes the peaks are higher and there's more, like, he scores more incredible goals and does like, more eye-catching things than Lewandowski. Whereas, you know, as a defender, like, if that ball comes into the penalty area, Robert Lewandowski will finish it, whether it's right foot, left foot, head, or whatever. So it's like they're both amazing, obviously, but they're both just different. I think Messi's just a bit glitzier, if that's I can't even say that word. You know, a bit
but
shinier.
That kind of lends itself to that argument that I just mentioned about it being a glorified popularity contest. Because if we're talking about who was the best player over the last 12 months, it's Robert Lewandowski without question. And I don't think Messi, as good as he is and will be regarded as one of the best, if not the best, to ever do it,
I think that he couldn't hold a candle to Lewandowski last year. And I think it was summed up really nicely in this tweet from football writer Stefan Biankowski, who said, "The sad fact is that had any player scored 41 goals in 29 league games in La Liga or the Premier League, there wouldn't have even been a debate over who deserved the Ballon d'Or. Lewandowski may not have won the prize, but this was in truth a massive defeat for the Bundesliga." What do you make of that?
Yeah, it sounds about right. Like the Bundesliga's had a lot of stick over the years with, you know, it's just a one-team race. And it does create a rod for its own back when Bayern go out and buy everybody's best players every year. And that's kind of what they did in 2012 or 2013 when they got Lewandowski, because he was the best striker in Germany. And they went out and got him. So they might do it again with Erling Haaland in a couple of years. You never know. But yeah, that is one thing that Bundesliga players will have to know. You've seen it with Heung-Min Son leaving Leverkusen, becoming one of the best wingers in the world and getting recognised for his talents a bit more by coming to the Premier League. And you see it with many players over the years. And you probably are, if you're Lewandowski, you probably have suffered for that by missing out on individual awards.
Yeah, I think Lewandowski can feel aggrieved that he didn't win it. Would he have been your pick as well, Joel?
Oh, 100%. The Ballon d'Or now is just a PR machine. It's just whatever player's got the biggest PR and the biggest brand, like Marley said, wins it. I mean, when you look at Lewandowski's stats, it's not even just for 2020 when he won the Champions League. Even just 2021 itself, he got 64 goals in a calendar year, which is like, I think, 10 more than the next than the next highest. Like, he's been out of this world in this for the last 2 years straight. I think the only reason why Messi is even in contention, and obviously 41 goals in a calendar year is always going to be like an amazing achievement, but the only reason he's even in contention and won it was because he won a Copa America, and that's the only reason. And let's not forget, in that tournament he wasn't incredible. He didn't light the stage up massively. But obviously, Ballon d'Or results always kind of favour those players who've had an amazing international tournament for 2 months out of the entire 12-month period that they actually voted for, which in itself is quite strange as well. But exactly like you said, Niall, the fact that 100 journalists from all these different countries vote, of course, there's way more Hispanic journalists from South America, and way more journalists that probably know of Messi more than Lewandowski, and they're always going to vote for him. And I think it's turned into a popularity contest now, truly. I mean, I was looking at the list of the top 30 Ballon d'Or players, and Gerard Moreno got a vote to win it. I mean, if that tells you everything you need to know, he's probably his best mate in the Spanish media has voted for him. It's ridiculous. How can you vote for someone like that to win a Ballon d'Or? It makes no sense to me.
Well, let's talk about Premier League representation in the Ballon d'Or awards last night. Jorginho, the Chelsea midfielder who plays for Italy, Brazilian-born, finished third in the standings behind Lewandowski and the eventual winner, Messi. He was the highest ranked of any Premier League player. I think Ronaldo was sixth. I think Phil Foden was 25th, and I think Salah was in the top 10 somewhere as well. In terms of Jorginho, Marley, being the highest rated Premier League player, so to speak, do you think that was warranted? Because, of course, he won the Euros with Italy and he won the Champions League with Chelsea.
No, I don't think it was that warranted. yes, it's a thing again, isn't it? You know, is it trophies, you know, that make you high up the pitch? Because nobody had a better year than Jorginho. He won the Champions League and he won the Euros. So if you're going
No one else did that. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
If you're going on trophies, then he wins it. You know, nobody beat that. Forget your Copa America. You know, he won the Champions League and his version of the Copa America. So I don't think it should be like that. And that's why I don't think he should be in there, because talent-wise, he's not the third best player in the world. He's very, very good, don't get me wrong. But if Jorginho is the third best player in the world, then over the years, Sergio Busquets has been screwed out of about 10, because he's been the best defensive midfielder of the modern generation for a good decade. You know, playing alongside Xavi and Iniesta, yes, is amazing and all the rest of it. But his reading of the game and passing is exactly what Jorginho does now, but arguably better. Well, I'd say not arguably if you ask me, but you know, way better. But it's just like the whole thing, it doesn't make sense. Like, they don't say it's about trophies, they say it's the best player, and they've give it to a player who wasn't the best player in the world this year, and then they've give it to they've give third place to a player who just happened to win the most in that year as well. So it's all very confusing. It doesn't really, there's no clear guidelines, because if you said it's about the players who wins the most, then it's Jorginho. If you say it's about who had the best year, it's Lewandowski, and neither of those answers are Messi, but it's PR, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I can't think the last time a Premier League player won the Ballon d'Or, and we always talk about how good the league is in our country, but I think in terms of all-round quality, the Premier League's the best, but individual quality, it's hard to look past some of the players of the likes of Messi and Lewandowski and even Ronaldo when he was playing his trade overseas.
I think it was Ronaldo, wasn't it, Cristiano, and at Man U in 2008 or something like that, but... Yeah,
it must have been. I mean, we've seen players like De Bruyne light the stage up, and Salah's been phenomenal as well. Lots of people suggesting that they thought he should have won it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to finish off today's podcast by asking, I'll go for you first, Joel. If a Ballon d'Or for the first 4 months of this season, from August till now, if we were awarding a Ballon d'Or tomorrow, just voted for by yourself, me and Marley, who would your vote be going to?
It kills me to say this. I don't know if I can say it.
I was going to say this is going to be painful.
Yeah, it would have to go to Salah, wouldn't it? I mean, if you look in all of world football right now, I don't think there's been a player who's impacted games so far this season more than he has. I don't know if he has the most goals in Europe at the moment. Maybe it is Lewandowski, but I wouldn't give it to Lewandowski right now, just because Bundesliga goals over Premier League goals, I will never, ever rate higher. But purely just because Salah's been doing it in Europe as well. And I really don't think there's a player right now who's in better form than he is, sadly enough. So yeah, I'd probably go with Salah. That would be my pick. Reluctantly, I'm biting my tongue as I say it.
Okay then, Marley, what about you? And I'm vetoing any vote for Joe Linton.
Or Josh King.
Oh, definitely not Josh King, Jesus. He's making a mug out of me. He keeps bloody scoring. He must listen to this podcast, you know.
After I said that five-a-side comment, he's been going crazy with the goals.
Josh, if you're listening, I still think you're crap, mate, but never mind. yeah, but nah, it has to be Salah, doesn't it? There's no other person out there. It's not even close. He's streets ahead. Bernardo Silva's having an amazing season as well at Manchester City.
Yeah, I agree.
But Salah, for his impact and his you know, his goals and the stats that back it up, you know, he's just by far the best in the world right now. And if he carries on to the end of the season, then there's no way he shouldn't win the Ballon d'Or next year, because no one's really close to him in the world right now.
Yeah, I think I'd have to make it a hat-trick for Mo Salah, particularly if we were just doing a Premier League award for the Ballon d'Or. It would have to be him. I think Karim Benzema's had a pretty good year as well, someone who maybe was overlooked, but not as good a year as Robert Lewandowski.
On the pitch, yeah.
What's that? On the pitch, yeah.
On the
absolutely,
pitch, yeah.
We are focusing on action on the pitch rather than off the pitch, otherwise you could have some rather suspicious votes. But that's it. Mo Salah takes our vote for the Ballon d'Or if it was awarded tomorrow. What do you think? Get in touch with us on social media at The Sports Social. On Twitter, you can find us on Instagram, Sports Social Official, and we're also on Facebook. If you just type into the search bar Sports Social, you can find us there. That's it for today's Football Social Daily. Thank you very much, Joel. I'll leave you to finish that can of Strongbow as well, Marley. And we'll see you again tomorrow as we look back at tonight's Premier League fixtures, as well as looking ahead to tomorrow's. Catch you then.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.